Launch all sequence has started.
Crew one for all.
Welcome to Moon Snacks. Great to have you back for our second season. So I'm Ed Hoffman. I am best known as a friend of Jessica Fox.
So Ed, this is our second season sending people to the moon. What lessons have we learned? Have we gotten better at this?
Well, one of the things we've demonstrated is that despite what others may have said, we're still back. We're still here. So perseverance counts for something.
And just to tease people, this season's going to be quite a doozy. We have some very impressive folks from a variety of different industries.
Interdisciplinary, yeah.
Interdisciplinary and interstellar.
Well, yeah, now let's go with eclectic, yeah.
And with them, they get three movies, a snack, and a book. And through those, we get to know them, what they do, what lessons they've learned about project management and leadership, and a little bit of their love of cinema, too. You're going to want to sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride with us.
I am thrilled to have a friend and a colleague, John Corey, who is with us today.
Can you tell us, before we dive into your films, a little bit about who you are and what you do?
So I'm quite an unorthodox leader. I'm a self-made high school dropout who struggled actually early in life with the system. But I am creative with music, with film. And in some ways, as I was starting to come of age, I started to embrace arts as a real outlet. But I was working as a tradesman. I'm a printer by trade. I worked for my father, which was a great escape from my struggle. And equally, it became an incredible outlet to not think about work and only think about playing music or being an athlete and having fun. But actually, what happened along the way was print is not spoken about very often, but is one of the first industries that was digitally disrupted. There was this period in my life where everything I'd taken for granted for work just disintegrated. And my father sort of passed away and we shut the business down. And I was in my mid-20s. So I was sitting there going, wow, what do I do now? I'm behind all of these people that have studied. And I met my wife, Melissa, who was studying at the time, working in corporate business. And I decided to go out and get a real job. But what was probably behind it that I didn't realize was an incredible hunger to learn. And then I was literally willing to work harder than anybody around me to prove myself. And I happened to just work for some wonderful leaders that saw that, that invested the time, that opened up policies, and I was the annoying idiot that walked through all the time and asked a million questions. And I sort of, somewhere between using the skill you have, so print in its traditional form, to get into large corporates that were buying print, so lateral moves that were leveraging my experience, and then moving into technology through IBM. So IBM were looking for someone who understood print media. So I threw myself at the mercy of the court and jumped into the Big Blue. And I love the Big Blue because you can learn whatever you want to learn and work as hard as you want to work. Along the way, there was one big sort of IBM catastrophe on a bank that they asked me to help remediate, only simply because I connected with a very difficult customer who IBM just couldn't break a relationship into. And I was able to understand what she wanted. Anyway, that was sort of my turning point as a leader. Because before that point, I was happy to sit in the background and just do work and be happy. But actually, the next 10 years has been sort of understanding my impact on people and how to lead at scale. And the person that asked me to fix the IBM problem moved to Telstra, and she had broken something else. So she asked me to come and help her fix that. My boss will say that I'm not that great in the Pentagon, as he describes, but I'm probably one of the better field leaders. So he needs me out in the field leading armies of people that need to understand the why, because our organizations make change. And we've got some smart people that get very frustrated with the way we make change, and we need to explain it to them. And I guess I'm reasonable at that.
I had similarly a boss who said, I don't need you in Washington. I want you out in the field, because you get people to be able to deal with the changes we're trying to deal with. That was the whole reason for the chief knowledge officer position is that they felt that the project engineering community would accept it more if I was running it. So I identify with these things very well.
You know, it makes me feel a little guilty that you're so good with people and we're sending you alone to the moon. So what is your first movie that you've decided to take with you?
So first movie was Reservoir Dogs. Reservoir Dogs is a movie about a bank robbery and a team that's brought together that don't know each other and use code names. So they don't know each other's past, but they're brought together through a common organizer named Joe, and the bank robbery goes off the rails.
Guess what? I think I'm parked in the red zone. Now, where were we?
I told you I don't know anything about any fucking setup. I've been on the force for only 8 months. They don't tell me anything. Nobody tells me shit. You can torture me all you want.
Torture you, that's a good idea. I like that one. Yeah.
I watched this film at a time in my life when I was learning to be an adult. And I guess I'd had some tough times. So I'd never understood cinema the way that this film sort of pushed me to understand that it could push the edge. In retrospect, it was challenging for cinema. It changed cinema. And I thought a lot about that when picking the film. So I loved the edge that it had. I loved the challenge that it had. I loved the conflict. I identified a lot with Mr. White, Harvey Keitel, who was actually conscientious and somehow trusted Mr. Orange through the film on the basis of nothing really, and in some ways stood with him against people that he'd known all his life. But there were also wicked turns of his character which showed a hard edge, and I sort of looked at that and went, wow, that's pretty amazing, and probably identified a little bit of that with me.
Did you see it in the theater?
Yeah, I can take myself back to that moment, actually, at the Kino Cinema in Melbourne. There were sort of two independent cinemas that I loved, and that one's still around. A very good friend of mine who was a bit of a mentor, she had said to me, you need to come to see this film. The other thing she asked me to go and do with her was to go and see Jeff Buckley when he was alive. So she was a great mentor to have around. I'd always loved movies, but I'd never really understood independent movies and that edge that it can provide, or that lens into different lives and different experiences.
I tend to look at things from the team, from the project. And so I love heist movies because it's who do you pull together? And as they say, you don't want to be Mr. Yellow. But you identify with the different characters. And the thing that, as I watched it, was one of the things I've never forgotten is that people remember things differently. They see things differently. And in working with teams, that's one of the things that, and being a leader, you can say something, but people will pick up different aspects to it. Different words have different keys. And so I love that kind of, basically a dysfunctional team where things go wrong. You know, you identify with that. So I was at one of those stages, starting a career at NASA, seeing, oh, this is the kind of teams that that you want to avoid, right?
Do you know, it also made me think, I used to work in a movie rental Blockbuster while they were renting VHS tapes. So this is going to totally date me. But I remember hearing that Quentin Tarantino also did and watched everything. Like, we just every night take stuff home. And I loved Reservoir Dogs because you could see the energy behind his love of cinema and just trying stuff and borrowing things. And it was this exuberance that I think gets beaten out of us the more we study craft or have to please stakeholders. There is this joy of letting his own instincts go where they may. And I think when we're working in teams, it's very important to remember, if we want our team to be innovative, to not, because of structure, stamp on some of that innate joy of creativity and trying things.
The movie surprised me a little bit. what is it about the movie that connects with you?
I guess it's a bit of a bridge when I talk about being a leader. At times you're in a persona of who you need to be versus who you are. And I think in some ways, I've spent my life trying to close that bridge, to be who I am, as authentic as I can be and true to myself. And I'm different, and I know I'm different. But I think the perception of me is that I'm quite vanilla in some ways, but actually I'm not. Anyone that knows me outside of work will say my taste is different, probably a polite way of saying weird. But in some ways, that film was important to me at the time of my life. It was cathartic in some ways, and I had experienced a number of difficult situations in my life where it made me feel okay. It provided this, you know, it was almost like that deafening silence of politeness that can happen in the real world. And then you go into this two-hour experience where it's just the incredible intensity. There's so much stuff that shouldn't be repeated outside of the cinema, but you think the ability to create and express that way, that situational problem solving that was happening in the film, also I identified with because I'm pretty good at it. But mostly Harvey Keitel. Like when I think about characters in cinema, he's probably my favorite character of all movies because he's constantly in this very strong position of thinking he knows where the direction is, using his absolute instincts and trust, and he's incorrect. and of course, you know, there's sidebars like Steve Buscemi's career launched from that film, you know, and so did obviously Tarantino. So I also love films that you could almost put on a stage. 12 Angry Men comes to mind, but you could literally play Reservoir Dogs on a... I think Tarantino at one point wanted to do a stage play with it originally.
But when I watch certain movies, I think about, okay, how could we have made this work? So if you were appointed the leader of that bungled group, did you ever, not to give any answers, but do you see yourself at that point of, hey, if I were running things there, this would have turned out better?
Possibly. I mean, I think the character that sent everything sideways in the robbery is Michael Madsen, just Mr. Blonde, because he went crazy in the shop. So, and when I think about your question, Joe is the ringleader of the pack, but to my earlier point, I'm better in the field. So how would we have identified the skills requirement not to send it off the rails, that someone was going to be a sociopath in the middle of it and send the bank robbery the wrong way? I have no idea how I would have identified the mole in the camp, which was Orange. And that's where I go back to, if I'm Mr. White, I'd probably make the same mistake. I trust somebody on that moment when he's shot in the belly. So I'm not sure, Ed.
I think the other thing I loved about the nature of the movie, to me, it shows two key principles of teams, organizations. One is be careful of who you select for that project. And once you've selected them, you better develop them and make sure that they know what they're doing. And I think if they had you or De Niro in that movie, it would have been a success story. But that's my movie.
I've never been put side by side with De Niro, but I'll take it. Well, actually, you raise another interesting point, and I'm on your tangent about scenario testing. That when stuff goes wrong, clearly the team did not test what would happen if something went wrong. There was a rendezvous, but that the rendezvous was never the place to go when things went wrong. So they had no plan B, really, when I think about it.
So if you're on the moon watching this, alone without a team, is it like more of a movie comfort blanket because you get in touch with that part of yourself? What is the movie going to mean to you on the moon?
It feels like the center of a compass. So whenever, because it does remind me of a time in my life where it centered me, it made me feel good despite the subject matter that was challenging. It sort of brought this center of everything for me, like it was a balance. And you know, we've got Hollywood cinema and we've got independent cinema and we've got polite stuff and we've got international, but it was sitting in the center and I went, yep, that's got it for me. So it almost helps me calibrate. If I watch it every 3 or 4 years, it just makes me remember how well a film can be made on the edge, like right on the edge. And I think if I'm on the moon, I mean, I did think about this a lot. I overthink things, as you are starting to understand about me. So I actually wanted to pick three films that gave me three different emotional experiences.
So if we're thinking of it like a really well-balanced meal emotionally, what is your second film?
The Intouchables. The Intouchables is a French film based on a true story about a successful businessman who became a quadriplegic in a hang gliding accident, doing something he loved, and was searching for his new carer and was going through the interview process when he comes across Driss, who is from the harder parts of town, low socioeconomic parts of town, but Driss is really doing it only because he wants a signature so he can get his welfare check, and he doesn't take him seriously. He doesn't treat him differently. In fact, he insults him a few times when he's in the interview, which makes him laugh and feel differently, feel alive that he hadn't felt before.
Bon, on y va? Ça fait une heure que vous êtes scotché là. Faut changer de chaîne à un moment là.
Beaucoup de sérénité qui se dégage de ce tableau, et même une certaine violence.
Je trouve très touchant aussi.
C'est touchant des taches rouges sur un fond blanc. Mais ça coûte combien ça?
Je crois qu'il est à 30 000 euros. Je peux vérifier si vous voulez.
Ouais, vaut mieux vérifier quand même. Parce que ça me paraît exagéré comme prix. Vous allez pas acheter cette croûte là à 30 000 euros? C'est pas possible ça.
Bah si, si, c'est possible.
Mais le mec, il a saigné du nez sur un sombre, il demande 30 000 euros.
Dites-moi, Adrice, à votre avis, pourquoi les gens s'intéressent à l'art?
Je sais pas, c'est un business?
Non. Parce que c'est la seule trace de notre passage sur Terre.
Une connerie, ça, Philippe. Moi, pour 50 euros, je vais chez Casto et je vous la fais, la trace de mon passage sur Terre. Je vous mets même du beurre bonus, si vous voulez.
Allez, arrêtez de dire n'importe quoi. Donnez-moi un chocolat.
And there's something about that film that touches me deeply. I identify with Driss coming from a sort of low socioeconomic challenging neighborhood. I love Francois Clouseau. I think he's a fabulous actor. So I grew up in the Eddie Murphy era of comedy, right? Like slapstick comedy, and fast lines everywhere. And there's a thread through it that despite the heaviness of the subject, the humor and the inappropriateness of the humor is sort of what brought them together. The fact that he didn't care that he was a quadriplegic and that he made inappropriate remarks, but that he wanted someone who didn't care. I also like the struggle he's going through with his own life. And he's a very proud person, and you learn that during the film, that he's actually very responsible despite his behavior. And I loved the giving. I'm a person that likes to give because I get a great experience out of that. And I think as leaders, one of the true treasures that I struggle to talk about, actually, but it's being able to identify somebody who can really fly and then helping them find their own confidence and fly is a giving. It's a giving motion. It's a giving emotion. And I love that. It's part of the true joys of the job. And I am good at it. When Driss gives him the gift of the date at the end, it's almost like the ultimate gift. And of course, the acting is just superb to capture that emotion. So I can't watch it without being a blubbering mess right at the end. That is a very different emotion to Reservoir Dogs.
For me, it's like about the power of authentic connection, like real proper connection, regardless of the difference between where people are coming from. Do you need that kind of connection with everyone as a leader?
I would say to you, I've learned to live less with it. Going back to some guidance I got from a coach who explained that leading at subscale, you can almost obtain perfection. You can pick the right team. You can sort of put your arms around the business. When you start to lead 1,000 people, you can't. And I literally struggle, Jessica, with the concept of walking into a building and someone saying, "Hi, John," and I don't know their name. And they work for me and I know their face. So I have struggled and even come to terms with just saying, "Hey, I'm so sorry, I've forgotten your name." But connection at scale, I think, is the point that you touch. And I had to learn that as a concept, that it didn't diminish me as a person, because it felt like it was reductive to me to lead at scale, until I learned that I could lead at scale with authenticity without reducing myself. Because my empathy says it's important to remember someone's name. I know how I would feel if someone forgot my name and I knew them. So I immediately put myself in the deficit. which is quite a risk for me. So I actually provide that guidance to leaders that it's that old cliche, right, Ed, where you've got a manager who's excellent at doing what they do, and then you promote them, and then when they're under pressure, they regress and go back to the things that they used to do. You have to learn to adopt a different set of attributes and principles at the next level, and that one leading at scale is hard, but it's also fun when you work it out.
I'm somewhat of a cliche because everyone knows that Ed says it's about the people. But what I found at NASA, when I joined NASA, I was quiet the first year because I didn't know how I got here. I was sure it was a mistake. I was from Columbia, so they thought that I was something else. And so I tried to keep it quiet. And I didn't talk too much about the human element or people, or I assume this is NASA. They've been to the moon. They do it through engineering and through smarts and through intelligence and through process and all these things. And fairly quickly, when I was there, I noticed that when they were successful, there's this human dimension. I'll actually say there was this love that comes from the collaboration, the challenge, the mission, that people wouldn't talk about in that term, but it was clearly that. And when there were failures, when there were big explosions, it was a residue of relationships that hadn't been worked appropriately. And a large part of my career at NASA was always unusual. My leadership used to have me focus on the relationships. The knowledge part was the sharing of knowledge, the notion that the three of us have ideas. Are we being open and honest? Do we have trust with each other to do that? It was less concerned about the tools to kind of capture everything. So I saw that through the successes and particularly through the failures of interesting what's going on here. And the issues weren't the technology. It wasn't the process. It wasn't, you know, the linear things that they needed to know. It was often something to do with the human element of who they were in relation to others, how they were prepared, how they were treated. When I got to the second year, I said, oh, okay, I don't know if they know why I'm here, but now I know why I'm here. And I would use words like that. I remember the first time that I used the word love at NASA. People kind of, they came up, that's weird, but people would say, that's right. But when I think about the word intouchable or untouchable, they almost have dual meanings. One is people you don't want to be near, right? The people you don't talk to, the people you walk around. But the other is people who have so much influence and power and so important that you better support them. And I think it's an interest. I don't know how it conveys with your connection to the movie, but I think one of the things that a good leader does is that they make all people feel special. They feel important, but not too important so that anybody can't talk to them, but also certainly important enough so that they're not ignored. It's a balance there.
In a critical situation where you need to connect with someone, you know, John, you brought up the idea of being able to connect with a difficult client that IBM really needed, or you were able to connect with them. And Ed, I know you have some stories of this too, but when have you been unsuccessful in actually connecting with someone but needing to motivate them in a different way?
Yes. And it was one of the harder lessons I learned. And it was really the uncomfortable topic of narcissism, in that when you confront trying to connect with narcissism, it's a slippery slope. And I'm one that I'm a genuine trust and connection, and I love building a team that just works for each other. It sacrifices and it understands the group goal. I had to learn how narcissism is the antithesis of that in some ways, in that it's not that it intends to be, so I'm being empathetic. It's that it knows no other way. And when you confront that in a team environment, the only real way around that is to work out the best way to influence it, to get the outcome that you need, which feels like you're working a lot harder to get the outcome. I'm sure you remember the old sitcoms where you had quicksand. it's sort of like walking through quicksand, where you sort of get through it, but it's heavy and it's hard and it can hurt. So I had a challenging experience with that, but I also have learned to deal with it and identify it most importantly, and not resent it, actually understand it, because it's really close to the most terrifying insecurity you can come across. So when you empathize with that, you then remove it and say, right, how do I get the outcome that we need for the business and find another way?
You know, I used to have the notion that you should be able to work with everybody. I had to get to a point where I would get comfortable with myself basically saying every relationship does not have to work and that it's not a failure for me or for that other person. And there were situations, there weren't that many, but there were times where I was able to make an assessment saying, this isn't working. And instead of going through the pain and going through games and the dances, let's end it here. Those were hard, but I'd have honest conversations. I had one person who was one of the smartest people that I had on the team and very dedicated, but wanted to do things, I would say 180 degrees different from where I was trying to go. We would have that discussion. And then I'd find out I'd leave and he was trying to take the team in a different direction. And I had to sit down and said, you know, the problem here is I don't trust you at all and I can't work that way. So we talked about how we're going to do it. I said, okay, let's give it a shot. A week later, same exact thing happened. And I basically said, okay, it's time to, this is over. You know, I think that on that person's standpoint, I think they, in some ways, maybe appreciated it, maybe respected it. It wasn't ugly or anything like that, but it was, we're going in different directions. So I think sometimes you have to get comfortable that every relationship, you know, it's not a failure when it stops. It may be the right thing to do when it stops and move forward.
You know, I have a very minor one that it reminds me of, but when we were making a film called Bluebeard, it was an old fairy tale and we really wanted to get it. It was a bit, period. And we really wanted to get a nice color correction on it. So my cinematographer, who's wonderful, Gary, got a hookup in this incredible kind of Kodak, I think, studio space. So we went and the guy stayed after hours for us and he was going to tweak the machines and make our film. This is like one of my first films, so I was very precious about it. It was supposed to be beautiful and he just didn't care. I mean, this was like his investment wasn't in it. He's doing it as a favor to someone and he did it without love and it looked horrible. And I remember just looking like absolutely horrified at Gary, and Gary didn't know what to do and he wasn't taking instruction very well. And we realized that he was staying towards dinner time. So one day we came with a massive sandwich for him. We went to the local deli and got a massive sandwich. He was so happy, he sat there eating it and let us do whatever we wanted to the computers. And so we realized, well, this is the favor. We give him a sandwich every time we come in and we do it for him. And it worked out beautifully. But it was the kind of thing where you had to settle on the idea that you're not going to connect with everyone. They're not going to. Sometimes people just won't care and they need a sandwich. Now, John, what is your third film?
It's Inception, the Christopher Nolan film, and I think he's one of our great modern-day directors. It's an incredible film about an idea, that the power of an idea, and that you've got this, it's almost like a crime film, where you've got a side using known skilled people that can manipulate and understand and manipulate the mind to commit a crime of planting an idea. And then there's the case of defending that idea, so that the whole thing is built around that. But the key character in the film has a lot of luggage. He has a lot of his own history and buried deep, and we find that out along the way.
When we're asleep, our mind can do almost anything.
Such as?
Well, imagine you're designing a building, right? You consciously create each aspect. But sometimes it feels like it's almost creating itself, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, like I'm discovering it.
Genuine inspiration, right? Mm-hmm. Now, in a dream, our mind continuously does this. We create and perceive our world simultaneously, and our mind does this so well that we don't even know what's happening. That allows us to get right in the middle of that process.
How?
By taking over the creating part. Now, this is where I need you. You create the world of the dream. We bring the subject into that dream, and they fill it with their subconscious.
How could I ever acquire enough detail to make them think that it's reality?
Well, dreams, they feel real while we're in them, right? It's only when we wake up that we realize something is actually strange.
For such a complex subject, the simplicity of an idea being the most powerful thing that you can have, I love. I was never really good at actually, as a storyteller. I'm not a good storyteller. My twin brother, I have an identical twin. He loves storytelling. Probably that's why I went the other way. But I sort of hid in the shadows for a long time at work. And what I realized is that I'm good at planting an idea and a concept that people can grasp. So whether it might be naming a team something, like we recently built a new function and we called it the Solution Hub. The first name for it was the Delivery Control Center. And I went, oh, my God, just kill me now. No one will want to work for the Delivery Control Center. But the Solution Hub might be more positive. So the idea of something and the way people will receive it in the workplace is crucial, actually, to them signing up to the cause. I can often slip into the pop culture references at work where I might say we're assembling a deadly viper squad to handle this type of work, which is the Kill Bill reference, around the best assassins we've got in the business with analytics. But people get it. Film and pop culture is a way for us all to be connected through a moment. So if you think about Back to the Future or The Karate Kid, we could say one reference in a movie and all of us will go, oh, I get that. So rather than storytelling, I found myself leveraging moments in pop culture that people could identify with. And then with Inception, it's this just incredible simplicity of finding the idea and beautiful nature and the challenge. I love the way that they construct the film, that their subconscious fights the idea or the intrusion. And I just love it. I think it's a complete film.
John, is there a particular scene that stands out for you?
I would have to say that the character Molly is so haunting that when Leonardo DiCaprio and her are sitting across the dining room table in the deepest layer of the dream, and he is explaining what he did to her, and I found that really, really painful, like in a way that I loved. But the action scenes also, Jessica, seem to go for a long time. So if you look at some of those scenes, that the scene in the when Arthur's in the hallway, and it almost felt like a 35, 40-minute action scene with this suspense building. So it's really not one scene. It's sort of a combination of how the climax of a film comes together in Nolan's world and how he uses music and the score to accentuate that drama, that intensity and that suspense. I find that really moving in his films. I found it moving in lots of his films. In fact, I only watched Oppenheimer a couple of days ago, and I immediately was listening for the score, knowing that it's something that is sort of hand in hand with his stuff.
It is amazing because that's how Westerns were built, most of them, that actually you get the script, you get the score, and then you'd start filming kind of both together. And Nolan's work marries the two so well that you almost get the feeling that he has a sense of the score that he's like, or a rhythm or music that he is directing to.
I think at the core of his is, again, his work is very much a project. Projects start with the dream. Early in my career at NASA, one of the things I would get, I had the privilege of having the classrooms of project and engineers. And I always say, get 20 good engineers, scientists, project folks together, and you can create anything. So you should be very, be very good about that, because that can go in different directions. But the dream is the spark. And I like that whole notion of even the notion of inception, that he's putting an idea into someone's mind. He's not trying to take something out, right? The normal thing. But that's really what a society does. That's what a project is about. You're planting seeds. And hopefully those seeds are for the benefit of humanity. It's also it's a painful movie because so much of it has to do with regret. He identifies regret with his wife and with his children, which is very strong. But also that's another warning in terms of projects. You can focus so much on the work that you lose the things that matter. So I just think it's such a powerful movie. And again, he closes things. The way a lot of projects, you don't know really what the ending is.
Because you were talking about the idea of planting a seed or a concept or the idea. And although you would reject maybe the title of storyteller, that you said you're actually quite good at creating those concepts. And Ed and I often talk about the power of metaphor as being the ultimate storytelling tool. And you've done it a couple times during the conversation so far. So you were talking about, in terms of your role, you said, think of a triage nurse. And you didn't use a simile. You didn't say, I am like. You planted the seed and it planted the seed immediately. You said, think of this, or you're Assassin Squad, or you're using metaphor in like a very skilled, powerful way. So I would push back and argue that's what a good storyteller does.
I'll have to reluctantly agree. And I will add that I haunt my teams with bad metaphors. There's two that I use. One of them is a shower curtain. Now, when I travel to the US, there's a lot of shower curtains. And I don't like shower curtains because they stick to you the worst possible time. But I use that as the metaphor for this is how a bad M&A integration looks like. And it's amazing how many people remember that and then they just roll their eyes and say, please don't talk about the shower curtains again. So it can be useful in a humorous way too, that it lightens the mood. But I do agree with you. I didn't realize that metaphor was part of storytelling.
So, John, who would you be in that movie? Would you be the dream maker or would you be the architect?
No, I think it'd be hard not for me not to be Cobb, Leonardo, because a little bit like Harvey Keitel in Reservoir Dogs, the conflict of him, his strength becomes his weakness and he knows it. He's building essentially a team around his own limitations because he knows he can't be the architect, otherwise Molly will, his own subconscious will attack itself. So I definitely identify with that conflict. And I think it's my empathy that is the instrument that creates that in me, is that can be my strength that becomes my weakness. I can focus too much on it or how other people are feeling and it can derail me.
I always identified with the architect.
Yeah, okay.
Particularly in Paris, being able to create Paris and the folds and all.
In terms of your creation of feeling when you're on the moon watching this, you know, Ed brought up the feelings of, you know, that regret is a theme, you brought up the scene with Leo talking, kind of admitting about the things that he's done. What's that feeling that it awakens in you where you felt it was very important to have it on the moon?
Okay, so I feel an exhilaration when I watch that film. I feel like I'm on a ride of these experiences and I love how they weave truth, so much truth into it, like you can never remember the start of a dream. You know, just those little moments in the film where they sprinkle the simplicity of what is really a complicated subject. And then there's that incredible combination of the score and the last third of the film. And then you sort of throw in Pete Postlethwaite, who's sitting on a hospital bed, who's a legend of cinema. And I think it's just the experience it gives me. It's sort of like a complete experience with so many brilliant actors.
We're getting to that time where you've chosen some brilliant movies. You are going to be, I think, well catered for emotionally, intellectually, artistically on the moon. So I'm feeling happy about that.
If not socially.
But eventually people will join you, I have no doubt. But you still have, you're going to be hungry. And you still have a snack of your choice, but we will give you an endless amount of that and a book.
Well, both of them have a very Australian connection. So the snack is Twisties. They're this sort of cheese crispy twist, like a solid twist. And I'm sure, but they're quite firm and hard in some ways and crumble. There's cheese and there's chicken. I never taste chicken, so it's got to be cheese Twisties. And it's really nourishing because all the colouring is still on your fingers when you've eaten it. So I don't know if there's any sanity wipes on the moon. But
is it like a Cheeto?
A little bit, but I think it's a bit firmer than a Cheeto. It's crunchier. And my book is also an Australian. So there's a book called Shantaram by Gregory David Roberts. Personal connection is when I was 6 years old or 7 years old, I think I was at primary school, and the neighbourhood that we were in had a prison not too far from there. And two prisoners escaped from the prison, and we were on an excursion that day. So it became, you know, when you're a child, you remember the dramatic emotions of two escapees running around. Shantaram is about one of those escapees, actually. His name is Gregory David Roberts, and he escaped from Pentridge. He then fled into India, and he has this dual role of being a slum doctor and running guns for the Mujahideen. It started in, and this is the strange part, it started in the non-fiction section and moved to the fiction section and has been critically acclaimed. Also, it's been stoned for its mistruths. It's controversial, but I believe Johnny Depp and Brad Pitt bought the rights to this thing 15 years ago when the book came out, and they only recently made a Netflix series about it with Charlie Hunnam. But I would say to you, it's still one of the most entertaining, well-written books. It's a beautiful story. It's dramatic. And there are elements of truth that I recall from that time. There are just, it just embellishes. He's a beautiful writer. Yeah, it's a good one. So I thought I'd bring a bit of Australian to the table.
Both a taste and a read, both of those things are yours.
The only request that I would have is I would get to the moon and I'd want to build a drive-in, because I think a drive-in cinema on the moon would be just awesome, right, with the dark background.
Everyone takes their lunar landers.
I like that.
Countdown sequence initiated. It's going to be quite a long trip, I think, to the moon. Eventually we will join you, John, but you are brave to be thrown into the into the darkness.
No, we have people up there already, I think.
So. That's true. You're going to get to hang out with Maria Tatar. I feel like you'll get on really well with her.
Roger, go.
All good. I'm ready to go.
Bye, John. Enjoy your trip.
Thanks, Jessica. Thanks, Ed.
Safe travels.
Wear your seatbelt.
Here we go.
Stay hydrated in the rocket. That's the key.
Okay. Bye.
We'll see you soon. Good luck.
Stage one propulsion is nominal.
Delightful to have you with us. Thank you for joining us at the
Moon Snack
podcast,
where we shoot people to the moon. And join us next week for our next guest and the next launch.
Moon Snacks is sponsored by Highlands and Islands Enterprise and Light Dark Light, with hosts Jessica Fox and Ed Hoffman, and special guest John Corey. It was produced, edited, and sound designed by me, Ben Pleas.
Highlands and Islands Enterprise is the economic and community development agency for the north and west of Scotland. If you're interested in seeing how we can help you, contact us at hie.co.uk.